Thanks for tuning in to the May 12th podcast. I'm Jeff Ratliff, Deputy Section Editor of the Neurology Podcast. This week's featured segment features a talk on managing adult attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In the other segment, you'll hear a talk on surrogates decision-making following acute brain injury. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology Podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online on the same webpage. It's easy and free for AAN members.
Hi, this is Tisha Mateed from the University of Miami with today's Neurology Podcast. In the April-May edition of the American Academy of Neurology's Brain and Life magazine, you'll find an interesting article written by Lisa Kuhl, What Neurologists Are Learning from Treating Adults with ADHD. It talks about intriguing genetic links among common disorders of the brain, including ADHD. With me today to discuss is Scott Hirsch from NYU. I should also mention that Scott is on the Brain and Life editorial board, and you reviewed this article, right, Scott?
I did. The first thing to realize is that ADHD is fairly common. And the Brain and Life article we're talking about cited this JAMA Open Network article in November 2019 that showed there was an increasing rate of ADHD in both adults and children, where you see a more than double of the rate from 2007 to 2016 to nearly 1% in 2016. And then amongst children, the percentage went up about 3 to 3.75%. So you're seeing an increase in prevalence in America. And so these patients are going to come to neurologists, adult and also child neurologists. So we're going to see these patients. And the question is, why are we seeing these rising rates of the ADHD diagnosis?
So why is it important for neurologists to know about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
So neurologists need to know, like I said, because it's fairly common. So you're between 1 to 4% of your patients are going to come in with these diagnoses across the country. And within the subset of neurology patients, that number is going to be quite a bit higher because ADHD happens to be comorbid with a bunch of neurological conditions like migraine, Tourette syndrome, and also the traditional psychiatric diagnoses, bipolar disorder, major depression, and substance use disorder. And the symptoms that ADHD patients complain of also could be mimicked sometimes by sleep disorders, which we'll see, like obstructive sleep apnea or restless leg syndrome. So we're going to see these patients. And often, you know, patients are treated for one condition like bipolar disorder or major depression. And then they come to believe they have ADHD because their child is diagnosed with it. And then, as described in the article, then the parent says, oh, do I have this? And so that's actually a common way adults seek treatment. And so how do you diagnose ADHD? Well, first of all, it's a clinical diagnosis, and this is also described in the article. Clinical diagnosis means that it's actually not done on the basis of neuropsychological testing. We don't have a blood test. We don't do functional imaging or structural imaging to look for brain abnormalities. We don't do an EEG. It's based upon the history, the symptoms, some bedside cognitive testing, and then, of course, the examination. So you're mostly ruling on other things. And that's how the diagnosis is made.
So just like some specific criteria for ADHD, just for our audience that probably don't treat a lot of ADHD.
So what you're looking for is a childhood onset of inattention or hyperactivity. Psychiatrists and neurologists have different scales they use to make that diagnosis. Most people don't actually use scales. We have screening tests that are used, but when you actually do the screening test, you'll see 3/4 of people who take the screening test screen positive for ADHD. So it's fairly sensitive, but not at all specific for ADHD. And so what you're looking for is people who complain that they have trouble paying attention, they're fidgety, they have trouble sitting still. They lose focus when they're concentrating for more than a half hour. They are easily bored. These kinds of things, and these are fairly subjective.
So a neuropsychological test may not be always needed. And we can sometimes just refer to, as you say, the clinical history, the comorbidities, and family history.
Well, according to the article, the Harvard clinical psychologist, Dr. Oliveira, said that the neuropsychological testing could miss patients with ADHD because they find the test interesting enough to score well on. even when you do it, some people can still walk away with an ADHD diagnosis on the basis of the clinical history and the clinical interview, and there's no objective science to back it up. In my view, of course, this is tremendously problematic.
How does ADHD affect traditional neurological conditions?
Well, ADHD, in terms of traditional neurological conditions such as epilepsy or migraine, simply put, it makes it more difficult to treat these conditions. So when there's comorbid ADHD, it's going to be a little more difficult to treat seizures because the stimulants used to treat ADHD actually can lower the seizure threshold. The medicines used for ADHD, some people think, can increase the likelihood of migraine. So these medicines can increase the blood pressure, they can increase the risk of stroke, they can increase the risk of other heart arrhythmias, they can actually cause anxiety. So the treatment of the condition certainly can influence the management of other neurological and cardiovascular issues in patients.
The article pointed to a rise in prevalence. Do you think it's really a rise in prevalence? Is it the internet and patients are self-diagnosing themselves more? What are your thoughts on that? And can treating ADHD improve neurological outcomes?
Well, the rise in prevalence has to do with, like you mentioned, the increased knowledge, awareness amongst the population about ADHD, but also the neurologist and psychiatrist going to conferences, reading more articles about ADHD, hearing it's so important to treat ADHD, we're missing this diagnosis, we should treat. And so you're finding it much more, much like if you remember in the late 90s, early 2000s, we were told pain is the fifth vital sign. Suddenly, we're using a lot more medicine to treat pain. So what's happened here is much the same with ADHD. It's so important for children to do well in school. They have to go to top colleges. So we've got to figure out, you know, whether we can improve their overall performance by treating ADHD. When years ago, there was zero treatment of ADHD, there was no diagnosis of ADHD. So now we're treating a large proportion of the population with these medicines. And I told you the rates. You know, you're talking 1% to 4% of the population. So you'd imagine the maximum percent of the population that's treated for ADHD with stimulants should be no more than 4%. Obviously, we're seeing much higher rates of the use of stimulants. And, you know, the complications here is that the cognitive issues people have with ADHD, when you can't even prove it on a neuropsychological test, what are you really treating? Now, we've suggested in the article there's all this overlap with bipolar disorder, major depression, obstructive sleep apnea. Those things are much more prevalent than ADHD by numbers taken together. The rising rates, you know, since we're identifying some phenomenon, it's real. People are complaining of something, but how we manage it and diagnose it changes over time. In many cases, people who get diagnosed with pure ADHD, they absolutely do very, very well. So typically, it's a history from, you know, childhood on of really having normal intellect, good performance, but certainly falling off in areas where you need to have sustained follow-through. You really need to stay on task. And as the demands of school increase, the academic performance falls down. You then treat patients with ADHD with stimulants or behavioral techniques, and suddenly that gets better. So I find actually it's more the psychiatric side effects or the comorbidities of ADHD get much better once you effectively treat ADHD. I haven't found that treating headaches gets better or seizures. Certainly it's the opposite, actually. We've had cases where people have fairly well controlled epilepsy, and then someone decides to treat them for ADHD and they have a seizure within a day of starting a stimulant.
I can imagine a patient with migraine that's having difficulty with concentration from these non-headache symptoms and then getting this diagnosis of ADHD and having some of that managed, and then the manifestation of the disorder having less of an impact because you're treating some of the comorbidities. I'm wondering how many patients were missing that we could probably improve outcomes by treating ADHD. What would you say some of the best pharmacological therapies and some of the more simple behavioral therapies are for treatment of ADHD?
The stimulants within the classes of methylphenidate and the mixed amphetamine salts, those are the mainstays of treatment. The medications that have some effect on focus and attention, or at least hyperactivity, like clonidine, that has some effect. That's a alpha agonist. Then you'll have Strattera, which is atomoxetine that works through a different mechanism, also a non-stimulant. those are less effective. And then you have behavioral treatments and a variety of things you've got to do once you start people on stimulants, mainly around expectation management, what we're trying to accomplish in treatment, what they can expect as the results and why they're taking the stimulants. So I outlined the scenario in which it's really effective to use stimulants, meaning there's a specific area of difficulty with attention, follow through, staying on task, and the stimulants have a really good effect. And that's what they're really great at doing. On the other hand, in terms of making you work longer hours and focus and be like a laser for 20 hours a day, that is not the goal of these medications or being able to study for 30 hours straight. This is what a lot of people take these medicines for, non-medically, of course, and that is not what they're supposed to be used for.
Are there any good resources for neurologists to tap into if they were deciding that they wanted to treat these patients to help with some of the behavioral management of this condition? Are there any programs or any good resources online?
Well, I don't know about online, but there is a cognitive behavioral therapy approach to ADHD with helping people stay organized and structuring their day. And that's something that a neurologist can recommend. It's hard to integrate that into your treatment because it requires more frequent sessions. So typically you'll need to have a weekly session with patients, but you can outline the strategies of what you're trying to accomplish. So typically what we do is we refer patients with ADHD to a cognitive behavioral therapist who works along with the patient on schedules, expectation management, being able to, you know, structure time and activities, keeping with the planning of 30-minute blocks and scheduled breaks. You know, we as neurologists can write to schools or to employers to help them implement these plans, but ultimately I tend to refer to a cognitive behavioral therapist to help with these things because it does take a lot of time.
Well, thank you, Scott. I think you've convinced me that I need to consider ADHD, how it impacts the brain and other neurological conditions.
I'm glad I did. The one thing I want to mention is there's a whole body of work about the non-medical use of stimulants that all of us should take a look at. Because here, the issue is that there's a tremendous amount of use of these medicines on college campuses. And that ultimately is not a good thing because it increases the likelihood of other addictions, or it's at least associated with higher addiction in other areas. And you end up with a higher rate of substance dependence. So we don't want that to happen in our patients. So we have to be cautious about the use. And the diagnosis, like I said, is one that's made clinically. So part of that procedure is to really take a look at the history of substance use and to make sure we aren't putting our patients at higher risk for problems like addiction.
We're really lucky to have you being both a neurologist and a psychiatrist and maybe having a bit of a broader view of this disorder and most importantly, how it impacts our neurological patients. So thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is Tisha Monteith and thank you for listening to the Neurology Podcast. Please check out the article in the April-May edition of Brain and Life magazine, which can be accessed online at brainandlife.org.
Hi, this is David Lapidus. Today, we're joined by David Wong, associate professor and neurointensivist at Yale, to talk about his paper, Concerns of Surrogate Decision Makers for Acute Brain Injury Patients, a U.S. population survey published in this week's issue of Neurology. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, David. It's a total pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Of course. So your paper lays out a study you and your team conducted on the driving factors behind surrogates' decision-making for patients who have suffered a severe acute brain injury. Can we take one step back, actually, and just have you explain to us what the primary motivation of your study was?
Yeah, absolutely, David. The purpose of the study was to try to categorize the U.S. population into different decisional groups or like-minded groups when folks are put into the situation of having to make a goals of care decision for a loved one that's admitted to the ICU with a severe acute brain injury. Now, you might ask, you know, every family member, individual is different, so why would one want to try to categorize people into general groups of decision makers? Well, you know, our authorship group, when we first started out, the main motivation that we had was to try to figure out a way to be smart about creating materials for families that would help them when they're making these types of goals of care decisions for severe acute brain injury patients. And by goals of care, I mean things like putting in a tracheostomy and feeding tube in an intubated patient that has a poor prognosis or making such a loved one comfort measures. We wanted to try to sort out high yield groups that we could create decision aids for that really address the main concerns that these different groups might have when making goals of care decisions. And it turns out prior research in general critical care for creating similar types of aids for other diseases has been met with some limited success, especially when targeting psychological outcomes for loved ones as sort of the main outcome measures. And our lessons learned from this prior research are that creating a decision aid, it may not necessarily be like a one size fits all type exercise. Is that to really create aids that are impactful, you really want to target, you know, the main concerns of the decision maker that are driving these decisions. So we thought that trying to create a survey that we could administer to the entire United States and sorting out some key groups that really think like-minded might be a high-yield way to sort of set up the stage for decision aid development in the future that might help people the most.
Really interesting and a pretty ambitious project too. Given the survey format of your study, there are a lot of interesting data that emerged. Can you choose one or two main findings to share with our audience?
Absolutely, David. We actually administered two versions of a very similar survey. The first version of the survey that we administered presented the participant with a case vignette of an older adult relative who was hospitalized with a brain injury and who had undergone treatment for 2 weeks and was projected to have a prognosis of what we called severe disability. That is, at that point, they had not yet regained consciousness, but at least there was still a chance of that patient regaining consciousness in the future and perhaps some limited ability to interact both cognitively and physically with their environment. And what we found was that when we administered a survey across all participants in the survey, it turned out that there were some concerns that surrogate decision makers had that were basically shared amongst everyone who took the survey. That is, people definitely wanted to respect what their loved one would have wanted, and people wanted to minimize suffering in all forms. However, what we did find was that beyond those shared concerns, we found that we could divide the groups of folks that took the survey into four separate groups. One group was primarily concerned with the fact that their loved one was on the older side and that they were concerned that a tracheostomy feeding would be too much, you know, for their old age. We found that another group was really concerned primarily with just having consensus among the family about the decision, about the final decision, that it was almost less about what the decision was and more that the fact that the family agreed upon it. A third group was really concerned that the prognosis presented by the medical team was inaccurate. You know, therefore, they had some trust in the medical team's ability to come down with a prognosis or prognostic range. And in the fourth group, we found that had some concerns about paying for long-term care, you know, the financial side of things. And overall, that group had difficulty sort of sorting out their main concerns in general. And the other thing I'll say is when we administered this survey again, but switched up the prognostic scenario to one where the loved one in this vignette was definitively going to be in a coma or a vegetative state long-term, we found that these same groups emerged, except that there was a fifth group that primarily focused on religious concerns as their sort of driving concerns for making decisions.
Really interesting. And it seems like your survey clearly captured a good swath of the U.S. population, because I feel like that's the majority of the scenarios which I found myself in clinically. Can you tell us perhaps, Dave, about a finding that you found particularly surprising from the survey?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because we did this with the U.S. population, you know, one of the advantages of the survey was that we didn't just elicit the groups, but we were able to figure out the proportion of Americans that sort of fell into each group. And one thing that we found that was interesting was that the proportion of people who fell into the group of having difficulty trusting the prognosis from the team, that proportion of Americans grew a lot with the survey that presented the prognosis strictly as a vegetative state moving forward, you know, as opposed to the first survey I mentioned, which is one sort of more open-ended, you know, severe disability, but not quite as strict with regards to prognosis, that for the second survey, there was a lower proportion of people who had difficulty trusting the prognosis. And what we found that was interesting too was for the vegetative state scenario that we presented, there wasn't really a strong correlation between folks who fell into this group with trust or prognosis and their religiosity, you know, the degree to which they professed that they went to church and religious services, that it really seemed like a cognitive issue with trusting the prognosis when the prognosis is given in a very strict sense. Whereas for the first scenario that I mentioned, that is the sort of more broad definition of disability, the group that had trouble trusting the prognosis was a smaller portion of the population. But there was a strong correlation with religiosity, a strong correlation with, you know, how often people went to religious services. So we found that to be a surprising finding in the study.
Really interesting. And I really have to congratulate you on being able to conduct such a scientific study on something that's so traditionally challenging. Really interesting data has emerged from your paper here. I want to end by asking, you know, we have a large audience of mostly clinical neurologists listening here. Do you have any specific advice for the consulting neurologist, something that you would like to mention that comes from the insight that you've gained from your study?
Yeah, absolutely, David. I think there's a number of things, but you know, ultimately we hope that the research sets us up for future projects to set up for decision aid development and that sort of thing. But I do think there may be some lessons that can be learned even with the day-to-day interactions that we have with families in the ICU. One thing I'd like to highlight is this idea of prognostic trust or trust in the clinician's ability to prognosticate. I think our study sort of reemphasizes this idea that it's difficult, right? Many of us have been in these situations either as a consultant or in the ICU where we feel the need to give a very specific prognosis to families about how their loved one might do. But I think one thing that might be sort of gleaned from this research is that families may inherently be less trustful of a prognosis that's given by the clinician that's highly specific. I think, in other words, there's some intuitive understanding that it's difficult even for an expert to be right on the nose with the prognosis. Families sort of intuitively understand that prognosis is going to be a range of different outcomes. And so I guess the advice would be for clinicians who find themselves in that situation where the prognosis is a bit uncertain to not feel pressure to have to be so specific with families. And to understand that actually ultimately families might focus on other concerns, you know, as opposed to prognostic certainty when a clinician is just honest about the range of possible outcomes that one might have.
Wonderful. Well, I will take that advice. Again, I've been talking with Dave Wong, neurointensivist at Yale, about his paper, Concerns of Surrogate Decision Makers for Acute Brain Injury Patients, a U.S. Population Survey. Dave, thank you again so much for joining us today.
David, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
This is Jeff Ratliff. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on phenotypic variability in ALS-FTD and effect on survival, as well as another article on in utero exposure to the Great Chinese Famine and later risk of intracerebral hemorrhage in midlife. Please take a look at these and other articles this week. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.